your last name? It's Mitchell...
Szczepańczyk.
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 Third time's the charm. Szczepańczyk.
Mitchell.
Very good.
Okay, good. That's quite a name. Wow.
Thank you. I studied long and hard to try to get a name that creative and unique.
What's the good, the bad, and the ugly of digital technology and how it's affected our minds, our ability to learn and communicate? Joining me right now is Mitchell Szczepańczyk, host of a radio program, WHBK Radio.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence, but not here. This is radio that respects your intelligence and challenges you to think and rethink. Where knowledge is power, this is powerful radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello, and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On this episode, we'll feature an interview with Andrew J. Schwartzman, a media and telecommunications attorney with the Media Access Project, a public interest law firm which has been in the front lines of developing media and policy and, to quote one of the group's former members, a champion most people never knew they had. The following interview was recorded on Sunday, June 24th, 2012. We are joined on the phone with Andrew J. Schwartzman. Andrew J. Schwartzman was an attorney with the Media Access Project, also known as MAP, which was a nonprofit law firm and advocacy organization which worked on behalf of the public to promote freedom of expression, independent media, and low-cost universal access to communication services. And we are joined on the phone with Mr. Schwartzman. Andy, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Is that a pretty accurate characterization of MAP?
Yes, it is. Over 40 years, MAP did a lot of things, but I think you summarized it very well.
When you describe MAP to folks who might be unfamiliar with it, do you what would be your introduction? Is it something along those lines, or do you say something else?
I would say that the Media Access Project is a public interest law firm which represented citizens groups on issues of telecommunications and media policy, such as cable television, children's programming, cost of service, internet access, and so forth.
My impression of my own experience with MAP over the years is that it's never really been a big operation. I'm guessing it's maybe in the ballpark of maybe four people. Is that right?
Four or five people, it varied. Sometimes we're as big as seven, but that's about right.
But MAP, we're referring to MAP in the past tense because, as was noted, and I actually blogged online myself, on May 1st, 2012, MAP closed down. Can you talk a little bit about why that was the case?
Well, it's pretty simple. The money just wasn't coming in. MAP operated for 40 years largely on foundation support, and it was never easy, but it just got to be harder and harder. And we reached a point where we thought we couldn't maintain the level of quality of services that we wanted to provide, so we thought time had come to shut it down. It's 34 years for me, so I figured that was a good run.
What would we talk about? I don't know if you can disclose this, but I'll ask anyway. What are we talking in the way of, like, a given budget for the Media Access Project?
Well, in its last year's MAP ran a budget of $600,000-$700,000.
How does that compare to, I mean, I'm in the course of a lot of the lawsuits that you and others at MAP had worked on and fought over, as with a lot of the biggest media companies in the world, which we'll be talking about in a little bit. I would imagine that MAP, by way of comparison, was kind of small compared to a lot of the law firms and media folks that you were fighting against. Is that a correct characterization?
That was generally the case. In some of our big cases where they had the top drawer lawyers on the other side, we were up against lawyers earning $900 or $1,000 an hour.
Wow. There was one post in particular I saw online. There has been a little bit of commentary regarding the Media Access Project, one by a former colleague of yours, Harold Feld, who writes on a blog of his called Tales of the Sausage Factory. He wrote on the very day that MAP had announced that it was shutting its doors, wrote a blog post where he
eulogized Matt, but also vented. Let me actually quote a little bit about this and get your take on it. I was at MAP, this is Harold Feld talking, I was at MAP for 9 years, and it was incredibly painfully difficult to get people to understand why having a law firm in Washington, D.C. to advocate for the right policy at the Federal Communications Commission or bring cases challenging these arcane policy issues, like how many television stations one company can own or whether we should allow Comcast to block BitTorrent and other peer-to-peer applications, mattered. Many potential funders were too pure to fund anything that looked too much like inside the Beltway advocacy. If you don't fund fund progressive advocacy, it dies. If you are too pure to fight inside the Beltway, you lose. You cede the battlefield to folks who care a lot less about being chaste and pure and above the fray, and who care a lot about persuading policymakers and the country to adopt their vision of what's right. So either pony up with the cash or get the policy you deserve. Do you kind of, I don't know if you would be interested in going on the record here, but what are your thoughts? Do you echo what Harold is saying here as far as this, him getting on the top of a digital soapbox and kind of venting his spleen here?
Well, I'm not bitter. Media Access Project was always a very hard sell. Left liberal funders are comfortable in many instances assisting grassroots organizations and in dealing with the content of media, but when it comes to taking on very technical, arcane legal issues, it's harder for them to understand. I don't criticize them for that. I, if anything, criticize us for not doing as good a job as we might in convincing them of the importance of this work.
Let's talk a little bit about, you kind of touched on this momentarily, but a little bit about the history of the Media Access Project. You just said that you were involved with MAP for about 34 years, yet we were just about to approach, I think it's the 40th year of MAP. Is that correct?
That's right.
So you haven't been involved with it since the beginning.
That's right. I was not the founder. The Media Access Project grew out of a lawsuit, which ultimately wound up in the Supreme Court. In the 70s, both the mainstream Republican and Democratic leadership were supporting the war in Vietnam. And a group of business people who were concerned about the adverse effects that the war was having on the nation and the world, wanted to buy airtime to carry anti-war perspectives. And they won that case in the Court of Appeals. The government took it to the Supreme Court, and the government prevailed in the Supreme Court. So ultimately, MAP lost the case. But in the process, it made many changes, many positive changes in broadcasters' attitudes towards carrying controversy, and in particular, how they covered the Vietnam War.
How did you get involved with the Media Access Project?
Well, right out of law school, when I graduated in 1971, I had worked for the United Church of Christ Office of Communication, which had a project representing minority groups challenging license renewals because of discrimination and employment. And I did that for a couple of years. Then I moved down to Washington and went to work for the government. But I'd always intended to stay in communications law. So when my predecessor at Media Access Project left, they recruited me, and I took over in June of 1978.
Media policy, and this is something of a big interest of my own, but it's the kind of thing where very rarely do you actually stumble upon it as a kind of entree into political involvement in one way or another. Usually it's my interest, my experience, that a lot of people will get interested in media and the policy and politics related to media only after they were interested in some other issue, like, for example, I don't know, anti-nuclear advocacy, for example. And then they'll try to get on TV, for example, and then they'll be stymied. And so then they'll try to find out why that they were stymied, and then they'll get into understanding the policy questions. How did you get interested in questions regarding media policy to begin with, especially after having worked on it and devoting most of your career on this?
Well, first of all, you're right. Media policy is always a second issue. Not always, but generally a second issue of concern. And one of the challenges we always faced was convincing people that they needed to deal with structural change in media in order to advance their core issues. I was always interested in the press and how, we didn't say media in those days, how radio and television influenced public opinion. And while I was in law school, an organization started up that was doing work with the Federal Communications Commission. I did an internship there, and as soon as I started working on that, I knew this is what I wanted to do.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those achievements that you and others had done at the Media Access Project. On the Chicago Media Action website, is a group that I've been involved with, and also I guess I should have mentioned this earlier, but I'll mention it now for purposes of disclosure. Andy and the Media Access Project has served as counsel for one action, which we'll actually be talking about at the moment, before the Federal Communications Commission. So Andy, in some respects, has been my lawyer, but we'll put that aside for the moment. I'd like to talk about some of the things that MAP has done over the years that has been, I count as great achievements. The big one that I would like to discuss now, Prometheus v. FCC. This was the historic lawsuit that blocked the FCC in 2003 from implementing the gutting of the nation's major remaining media ownership rules, would have dramatically escalated media concentration had that lawsuit not succeeded. So, Andy, what are your thoughts regarding Prometheus versus FCC? Big win?
Well, it was a huge win because there were literally billions of dollars worth of transactions that had been lined up by broadcasters waiting for what they knew was going to come from the FCC. Had we not obtained an injunction stopping those new rules from coming to effect in 2003, there would have been a dramatic and radical transformation in the concentration of media ownership over the course of a relatively few months. We put a halt to that, and the FCC tried again, and we got the court to reverse a second time. And the FCC is looking at it one more time, and, you know, there may be changes, but if there are, they're going to be much more modest than what would have happened in 2003. And those, of course, would likely be appealed as well.
One other big win that I think that the Media Access Project can hang its hat on, the efforts with regards to low-power FM radio. The Prometheus Radio Project, actually, were the lead plaintiff in that Prometheus v. FCC case, released a statement where they said, quote, "When the Prometheus Radio Project started out as a small grassroots organization, we could not have created change in Washington without the guidance of MAP, the Media Access Project. MAP helped us to navigate a path to transform our demands and demonstrations into lasting policy decisions. We're grateful to MAP, not only on our own behalf, but on behalf of the communities across the country who have better media thanks to MAP's tireless efforts." And this is also a big win, but it was also at least a decade in coming. And I'd like you to talk about MAP's role in helping to make what we hope will be an improved radio environment in the United States come to be.
Well, low-power FM is a great success story. As of now, there are 800 or 900 low-power FM radio stations on the air across the country, mostly in smaller communities, rural and semi-rural communities. The National Association of Broadcasters was able to get Congress to pass an appropriations law rider that limited the location of low-power FM stations in more urban areas. And working with Prometheus, we were able to get that reversed in 2011. And the FCC is now in the process of awarding another 1,000 or so low-power FM stations, and this time they'll be in larger cities. So it's been a real success story, and these are real community stations, so you know that part is a real success. It also, from my standpoint, was a real success because of the collaboration that's described in the statement that you read. Media Access Project served as the quarterback for the legal strategy and getting the FCC to adopt the necessary rules and fighting off the broadcasters. Had to go to court a couple times. Had to get engineering studies done and deal with all. They tried to throw every kind of obstacle they could in the way. But it was done in collaboration with the low-power activists around the country, who had the organizing capability and the engineering skills to actually help get stations up off the ground. And you know, we assisted with applications and dealing with the various obstacles could come. So it was quite a collaboration and something that I'm extremely proud about.
There's another case, I think this was also at the Supreme Court, a little bit more of a mixed bag, because even though it was a loss, but sometimes even losses can have silver linings. The Brand X case. This was a lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court in 2005 regarding the FCC's authority to change their policy regarding public protections regarding the internet. The lawsuit, as I understand it, did lose, but it did open the door for the efforts with regards to what became known as network neutrality in the fights that proved to have some success in 2006. And actually, an FCC policy on net neutrality, however flawed, but nevertheless was passed in 2010. Tell me some of your thoughts with regards to Brand X.
Well, Brand X was a very confusing case, and for some technical reasons, I would have hoped that it had been litigated differently. We couldn't control all of the litigation strategy on that. But as it played out, as you described, it did open the way for what became the network neutrality rules. It is an example of how legal judgments and technical expertise can make a difference. Brand X, the company Brand X that was involved, made a strategic decision that I think was a mistake, but nonetheless, we did obtain something useful out of it.
This is kind of where I'm going to dovetail back into some of the work that I've been involved with regards to Chicago Media Action, the group in Chicago I'm a part of. There is still standing before the Federal Communications Commission a license challenge before 9 Chicago area TV stations, despite the fact that it was filed in 2005 and has been rejected, I count, 4 times in those years since. I guess I'll say this publicly. We couldn't have done it with the help of the Media Access Project. What are your thoughts with regards to this particular license challenge?
Well, it teaches a couple things. The whole point of this case was to bring the FCC facts that would be rather unassailable, showing that all of the stations in Chicago, singly and together, the TV stations, had failed in any meaningful way to provide coverage of local elections, that all their coverage in 2004 was really concentrated on the presidential election. And so we did an extensive monitoring with help of local groups like yours and brought that to the FCC. And institutionally, whether it's in the hands of a Democratic or Republican administration, institutionally, the Federal Communications Commission doesn't like to take away licenses. So we knew ultimately that this would not succeed at the FCC, and it hasn't. And the FCC has taken its own sweet time about dealing with it, but this stands as a marker and something that we may be able to appeal someday and kind of force the FCC to do something.
I've gone through a number of various issues here that the Media Access Project would count as wins for the Media Access Project and for media policy in America generally. Are there some that I haven't mentioned that you feel like should get some hearing now that you feel would come to mind as you think back on your career with the Media Access Project?
Well, certainly getting more diversity on cable, although it's still not anywhere near as diverse as we would like, has made a big difference, and we've done a number of things that that have accomplished that, and there's still a number of things in the works that that the FCC has done just recently that advance that cause. So that's one area. The other thing I would point to has been getting some controls on children's television, limits on the amount of commercialization on children's television, and elimination of abusive practices like hosts selling products for children, and actually having a requirement that there be some programming of an educational component on for children. And so that's something that that I feel, you know, very good about. There's many others, obviously, but those would be two that I would point to.
Some months ago, I had received an email from the Media Access Project, as a number of people did on MAP's emailing list. And when I saw the announcement that MAP was going to be closing its doors, my heart sunk immediately, not only because I knew that a big fighter on behalf of the public regarding media and media-related issues was going to be lost, but I think that the loss for the public interest might be feared generally. And so this is what I'd like to ask you about. I'm afraid that the loss of MAP may mean a loss for the public down the road in one or another capacity that we can't yet foresee. Do you think that, despite the fact that it's closing down, that you think that there's going to be some loss here?
Well, you know, you couldn't do what I've done for 34 years without being an optimist. And I tend to be optimistic about things. There's definitely a gap. I think there's going to be a loss, and there's some important fights will not be fought as a result of Media Access Project's demise. But one of the things that I'm perhaps most proud about during our tenure at Media Access Project was the large number of young people who received training at Media Access Project and who have stayed to work on public interest media and telecommunications policy. And they're sprinkled throughout the public interest community in Washington and elsewhere around the country and in the government. And I have a lot of confidence that these young people are going to continue this work and will be able to succeed where we may not have accomplished everything we'd wanted to do in the past.
Do you count that as MAP's most lasting legacy, or is there something else that you think will be the kind of thing that down the road people will remember MAP most notably for?
Well, I'd like to think that's the MAP's most lasting legacy, is the number of young people, because there was a time 15, 20 years ago, when, as one of my colleagues said to me, everybody working in public interest media issues are aging baby boomers. And I set out to try to develop the interest of younger people and to get them trained. And, you know, I feel very good about that.
All told, and this is kind of where I guess a larger scale look of history might be at play here, do you think that the overall terrain of media policy is better than it was when you started working with the Media Access Project, or worse, or more or less the same?
That's a complicated question. It's not static, of course, because the technology changes. And so you have to sort of analyze it in proportion to the technology. And I would say that the environment... It is easier for people with ideas to get some distribution for them, and that's a positive development. In the mainstream mass media, the concentration of control has made it more difficult for diverse ideas and opinions to go forth. So it really varies depending on how you look at it. But I, again, being an optimist, I think the technology favors disruptive forms, and that over time the media environment is going to improve.
And that kind of leads me to the next question I actually had planned to ask. Social media, social networking, and the internet. I can imagine a lot of people who would say, and pose the argument certainly to me, that, the big media companies are just dinosaurs, and even though they hold sway now, everyone's logging on to Facebook and to Twitter and through email and various other technologies and through their smartphones, and are able to distribute ideas at a greater speed and with a reach that some people might say might be comparable to those of the big media. Do you feel like this is a kind of characterization about how things have changed or not, or things haven't changed?
Well, I think the importance of social media in the context of the larger media landscape is that it takes increasing amount of control out of the hands of the owners of big media. That is, an article or a controversy can go viral, even if it's deemed to be unworthy of attention by the editors and those who control the media outlets. And issues can be forced onto the agenda that way. So I think that social media has a positive contribution to make in that regard.
I'm reminded of the example of Occupy Wall Street. That was actually, that might be an example, maybe the most famous example, of an issue of a group or a campaign or whatever that basically through social media and through a number of lucky breaks was able to thrust itself into large mass consciousness and the corporate media, despite efforts to try to dismiss it, belittle it, or just plain ignore it, nonetheless was forced to make it an issue. Would you agree, or is
yes,
that...
Yes, I would absolutely agree. That's emblematic of the kind of thing that I'm talking about.
And a last question: what does the future hold for Andrew J. Schwartzman? Do you have anything planned after the Media Access Project wraps up?
Well, I'm doing some work for another public interest group called Free Press for about 10 hours a week, but. Other than that, I'm going to take a couple months, take my time, and not jump into anything right away and see what I'm going to do. I'm sure it's going to be advancing the public interest somehow, but I'm going to figure out what's possible before I take any steps.
And for folks who want to follow the progress of Andy Schwartzman, are you on Facebook or Twitter?
I have not been very active on Twitter of late because I've been awfully busy. I'm on Facebook, and also we have a daily email which is still operated off of the Media Access Project website. It was called Daily Roadmap, and I've changed the name to the Daily Item, and I'm going to continue that in my own name as a Daily Item. So if people go to the mediaaccess.org, the website is still operative, they can sign up for Daily Roadmap, and they can get a daily email with musings on what's going on.
And the website, again, mediaaccess.org. We've been speaking with Andrew J. Schwartzman, an attorney with the Media Access Project, which was a nonprofit law firm and advocacy organization which worked on behalf of the public with regards to assorted media and free speech issues. And we've been speaking about his career and the history of that work. Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mitch.
Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.